It's time for Hoosier History Live, a weekly adventure through Indiana history, live with Carlin, hosted by author, historian, and connoisseur of all things Hoosier, Nelson Price. The call-in number is 317-788-3314. And now on to Hoosier History Live.
Good morning and welcome to Hoosier History Live. I'm your host, Nelson Price. As you surely must be aware, what with all the hoopla, this year is the 100th anniversary of the opening of our world-famous Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Well, on today's show, we're going to explore the colorful life of the entrepreneur who, more than anyone else, was the key figure in the founding of the racetrack. Greensburg, Indiana native Carl Fisher had a roller coaster career in life with great triumphs, including some that stretched far beyond the speedway, such as the founding of Miami Beach as one of the very first resorts in Florida. But his life also had real lows, ending with the loss of his fortune several years before his death in 1939. Joining me in studio today to guide us through is someone I've known for 100 years. Not really. It just seems that way. We met at the very start of our careers in media and history here. With me is public historian, colleague, and longtime historic preservationist, Glory June Greif. Among her fields of expertise, Glory is an expert on the life of Speedway founder Carl Fisher. Welcome to Hoosier History Live, Glory June.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, great to have you. And I want to mention right away that Glory also is an expert on sculptures and monuments all across Indiana. She's the author of a book about that entitled Remembrance, Faith, and Fancy. So down the road, I hope to do a show with her about Indiana monuments.
That'd be great.
And I have to share, Glory herself has a radio background. In fact, the two of us first met when she was on the air at another station. I thought you were billed this morning, Glory, but that's just
what people... I was Glory in the morning.
Glory in the morning.
Somewhat reluctantly in the morning.
And I was a college intern at the Indianapolis Star News, so that wasn't yesterday, folks. That was many yesterdays. And speaking of yesterday's history, both Glory and I became immersed in it. And today our focus is Speedway founder Carl Fisher and how the 500-mile race got started. Plus, we'll explore Carl Fisher's mansion that's now a landmark on the Marion College campus. We'll also explore his role with the Lincoln Highway that cuts through northern Indiana, his creation of Miami Beach, his daredevil promotional stunts, and his marriage to a 15-year-old Indianapolis woman. There's so much turf to explore. And you can join in with questions and comments. This is a call-in history show, maybe the only one in the country. We're eager to hear from you. So the studio number to call in and ask us questions on the air or offer insights is 788-3314. That's 317-788-3314. Also, during today's show, we'll hear from our road tripper correspondent, who will be calling in with the Hoosier Heritage Report, and we'll also have a Hoosier History Trivia Mystery question with a prize to the listener who calls in with a correct answer. Now, on to our very intriguing and timely topic. Let's cycle back later in the show to Carl Fisher's beginnings, but how about jump-starting us with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway?
Bad.
Carl Fisher, I'm sorry, excuse the puns here. Carl Fisher in the early 1900s sold automobiles here. He personally owned, Glory has told me, one of the very first, if not the first car in Indianapolis, and he had an auto showroom. And all of his life, Fisher was a masterful promoter. Glory, can you explain why he and his... He had three partners in the purchase of the cornfields far west of downtown. It wasn't racing initially they had in mind, right?
That's true. Well, first of all, he had partnered with James Allison mm-hmm. in the Presto Light Company. The Presto Light Company, P.C. Avery, an inventor, had developed a way to compress acetylene gas. And the idea was lights for driving at night.
Yeah,
now,
headlights.
Carl Fisher had
mm-hmm.
very poor vision, so mm-hmm. anything that could help him see better was a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So He jumped into that as an investor. The problem with acetylene gas is it had an unfortunate tendency to explode.
You're right.
So the city of Indianapolis decided this was not a good idea to have it within the city limits. They looked for some farmland and found quite a chunk of land.
And apparently it was called the Old Presley Farm.
Yes, yes.
Where the track is that they purchased with that in mind. It was cornfields.
They located the plant on the south side of Crawfordsville Road, and the smokestack that says Prestolite is still standing there. At least it was the last time I was out there.
Wow. Oh, cool.
And then the north side is where in 1909 they built the track, but not for racing.
Yes, it was actually built as a
testing track. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the four partners were all involved in automobiles in some way. Arthur Newby was part of the National Car Company. He was the owner of that and was looking for ways to improve that vehicle.
And Newby was very identified with bicycles.
Very identified with bicycle racing, as was Carl Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Wheeler was, of course, the manufacturer of carburetors.
Frank Wheeler, local businessman.
And Allison and his Prestolite. So they all were very steeped in automobiles, and also they all were very steeped in bicycles and motorcycles as well.
And actually, since we're on
they're all interwoven that way.
Yes, and the four partners, Fisher, Allison, Newby, and Wheeler, Fisher is always the focus, and I've had people ask, you know, there are these other guys involved too. Was it Fisher's outsized personality, or was he the leader of the four? Is that why he's kind of the first among equals?
You cannot deny that Fisher had an outsized personality.
Right.
Yeah, I think it just people naturally gravitated to him. His smile was his greatest asset, it was often said. He had a glad hand for everybody, and he had ideas a mile a minute. Always the craziest
ideas. Impresses me as the kind of person that always had to top himself.
He was known as Crazy Carl.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in a bad way. What will Carl Fisher come up with next? I mean, long before he got together within the Prestolite Company, he was already making his reputation that way. Always to promote and get new ideas all the time. He liked to see the dirt fly.
That's great. All right. Well, let's start with the track. So in 1909, they created as a testing ground for cars.
Motorcycles.
And as I think a lot of people know now, because there's been publicity about it, and actually it was our very first trivia question on this show, what was first raced there? It wasn't any of that. It was hot air balloons. Mm-hmm. And Carl Fisher himself competed in this. He piloted a hot air balloon called Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I guess some huge crowd, 40,000 people, gathered to watch this hot air balloon race.
And Fisher was very associated with balloons long before that as well.
Yes.
He had used balloons in his various promotions.
And so he ended as I guess it was a distance race.
Yes.
And
he went quite a distance.
Yeah, either Tennessee or
Virginia.
Either
Tennessee or Virginia, the sources differ. So I'm not going to say.
And along
one.
The way, this is so colorful. Apparently, farmers, like when he was flying over Brown County, farmers came out with guns, and did they think this was an alien invasion?
Probably so. Certainly something from the devil. What happened particularly was the drag line of the balloon caught in a tree at wherever the point was, whether it was Virginia or Tennessee. And the mountain folk from all around thought it was something horrible, and they did begin shooting at him, which could have been very bad.
Oh, exactly.
So they yelled and screamed and said, no, we are men, and so on and so on. And they got him down from the tree, but the farmers on whose land he was about to shoot him before he was always a good talker.
So yes.
He managed to talk him out of being.
Oh, thank goodness for that. So I guess the winner made it all the way down to Alabama. But then there was a motorcycle race in 1909, then the first car race that was such a disaster. I wanted to mention when they initially built the track, apparently it was horses and mules that were hauling this crushed stone. And then
held together with tar. So something like a macadam surface.
Mm-hmm.
very similar to the roads. I grew up in rural Indiana.
Yeah, you grew up in northern Indiana. Tell me the community again.
Hudson Lake.
All right. Because we're going to, I think that's relevant for something we're going to get to in just a minute. Yes. So the track was built with this crushed stone. And I know, as Gloria said, there was this tar involved, but apparently it didn't hold together well. And the first car race, it wasn't the 500 race yet. It was in 1909. And the track surface broke up and this crushed stone. Yeah. Six deaths, two spectators, two drivers, two crew members were all killed. And so, as I understand it, Carl Fisher went back to the drawing board and...
As he was wont to do.
Yes. What a visionary, and decided this, it needs to be paved with bricks.
Came up with the idea of bricks and used 3,200,000 bricks.
You know the exact number. Yes.
And so they began in 1910 two whole races again. But again, they still were not the 500 race. They were still racing motorcycles and automobiles, of course.
Ironically, yesterday, one of the bricks came loose, and there was a little mishap there at the track. It reminded me of all this. But then, so the first 500-mile race wasn't until 1911.
Yes.
And
that was, again, Carl Fisher's idea. Let's make it a really big event.
Oh, boy, he definitely dreamed big, didn't he?
Absolutely.
And he also, while all this was going on, he lived in this mansion, I mentioned, now part of Marion College, and all sorts of fascinating features to the mansion. One you told me about some time ago, he had a five-car garage.
He did indeed. Unheard of almost even today, let alone back in 1909.
Yeah, because most people didn't even have a single car at that point.
That's correct.
And he has a five-car garage.
Remember, the Model T was the vehicle that really got ordinary people into automobile driving, and that had only been developed the year before. So very, very few people owned automobiles that early, let alone five. But Fisher, of course, had several. He had his house, he acquired that house very shortly after his marriage in 1909 and immediately began to alter it and add more buildings and add all sorts of outbuildings and niceties to the house.
Right. And then he had tennis courts.
Polo. He had a polo stable and a polo field for his horses. He played polo, too. He was into everything.
Yes.
Pretty much.
And you said his wife, Jane, and we'll get to her more in a minute. But Jane, they even built a chicken. She wanted to raise prized chickens.
Prized chickens. She had this notion that she wanted to raise prized chickens and get into eating her own eggs that had been laid by her prized chickens. And she did. And her husband joked with her that each egg cost about $5 after he built this fancy chicken coop for her.
Well, his beginnings were very different from this lavish estate lifestyle.
Indeed.
It was called Blossom Heath, right?
Blossom Heath was the name.
Yeah, but he was, as I mentioned, born in Greensburg, kind of a hardscrabble family.
Very much.
And the father, somehow the father disappeared.
Disappeared. His mother ran, depending on the source, a hotel or boarding house, which is roughly the same thing, a very cheap, probably for traveling salesmen, that sort of thing. And Fisher was handicapped.
Yes, because of this vision.
Very poor eyesight.
Always wore
eyesight.
Thick glasses.
Yes, he had extreme myopia. So,
do you think he would have liked to have been a race driver himself?
And he did.
but the vision that must have affected his ability.
I can't imagine being myopic myself. I can't imagine doing some of the things he did as both a stunt promoter and race driver. He raced motorcycles, which is perhaps even scarier than racing cars.
With those glasses. Yeah, exactly. Well, we have a lot more to get to, but I want to take a call right now. Our road tripper is on the line. Our road tripper calls in every week with a Hoosier Heritage-related report. And our road tripper is Chris Gall of the Indianapolis Convention and Visitors Association. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you, Nelson. I'm coming to you from the 100-year-old oval here where...
Oh, you're at the track. Yeah. What's going on out there right now?
Well, the cars are just trying to dry the track, so hopefully they get up and going. But it's interesting to look at the yard of bricks and think that one of them flew off yesterday.
Yes, exactly.
I wanted to mention real quick someone you are familiar with, Angelo Pizzo.
Yes, the screenwriter of Hoosiers.
Yes, and Rudy. And I had a chance to catch up with him last week and talking about the hopeful movie celebrating the 1911 Indy 500 that
he's
written.
Yes, Angelo's, you're right, he's been working on that a long time.
So, fingers crossed that that comes. But listen, I want to take our listeners to Columbus, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Zaharico's Confectionery is an iconic establishment there in downtown, located in a 19th century building, and it just completed a massive restoration. A grand reopening is happening June 6th, and of course the centerpiece of this place is a 102-year-old Welty organ, which the owners purchased from a German manufacturer back in 1907. So the building is rehabbed, and you have a chance to head there for some good treats and soda fountain and a big celebration downtown Columbus. So vintage autos, a lot of good music, and the Welty organ. Are you familiar with that organ?
Well, I'm not, but it sounds... Glory, are you? My guest, I think, is quite familiar.
I'm excited. I'm there.
Really?
Oh, good.
You're familiar with the ice cream.
It's a fantastic place, and I watched it... it was going into a bad way. I would always stop there when I was in Columbus and go in and just marvel at this soda fountain and the organ and everything inside. All the accoutrements are original. It's just a fantastic place, but it was really dying. And then the last several times I'd been through Columbus, it was closed. So I was really worried.
Well, I will
about
look forward to seeing there June 6th. And I'll send it back to you guys from the 100-year-old oval where hopefully we get some racing.
Yes, okay. Thank you very much. Have a great day out there, Chris.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
We'll credit, by the way, our producer, Molly Head, for giving us the, pardon this pun too, the scoop on the ice cream shop. Because Molly is from Columbus, Indiana herself. So I am now going to throw out our Hoosier History Trivia Mystery question. Every week we pose one of these to listeners. Listener who calls in with a correct answer gets a prize. Today, a listener who calls in with a correct answer will receive two sets of tickets, one pair to the Idle Drug Museum and another pair of tickets to Comedy Sports on Mass Ave. All these tickets are courtesy of the ICVA, our Road Trippers employer. The number to call if you think you know the answer is 788-3314, and I'll repeat the number after I pose the question. Here it is. When the Indianapolis 500, by the way, I always try to make our questions related to the topic at hand, so it is Speedway related. When the Indianapolis 500 was suspended during World War II, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway greatly deteriorated due to neglect. After the war ended, weeds were growing up in the racetrack. Serious consideration was given to abandoning the 500-mile race and converting the Speedway into a housing subdivision. However, a famous Hoosier convinced Terre Haute millionaire Tony Holman to buy the Speedway in 1945, and the Indianapolis 500 went on to even greater glory than before the war. Our question is, name the famous Hoosier who persuaded Tony Holman to buy the Speedway. The number to call if you think you know the answer or if you want to join in our conversation today about our topic, number for any of that is 788-3314. Well, coming up, we'll take listener phone calls and talk more with my guest in studio, public historian Glory June Greif, as we explore the colorful life of Speedway founder Carl Fisher.
Hoosier History Live is underwritten in part by Nestle Inn Bed and Breakfast at 637 Northeast Street. More at nestleindy.com. By the Story Inn in Brown County, one inconvenient location since 1851. Online at storyinn.com. And by Print Resources, business-to-business printing and promotional items. More at printindy.com.
And Hoosier History Live is underwritten in part by Historic Landmarks Foundation of Indiana, presenting the Central Indiana Preservation Awards and FLIP benefit Thursday, May 21st. More at historiclandmarks.org. Well, we're back. If you're just joining us, this is Hoosier History Live, and I'm your host, Nelson Price. On today's show, we're exploring the colorful life of Speedway founder Carl Fisher as we mark the 100th anniversary of the opening of the legendary racetrack. Joining me in studio is public historian Glory June Greif. In addition to being an expert on aspects of our heritage, such as sculptures and monuments across Indiana, Glory June is an expert on the life of Carl Fisher. We've been talking primarily so far about the Speedway and automobiles, but his influence went way beyond that and beyond Indiana. He kind of always had to top himself, as I understand it. So after Carl Fisher got the racetrack up and running into the 1920s, he turned his attention to Florida and specifically specifically to some swampland near Miami. Explain what happened, Glory.
It was a mangrove swamp. Carl,
the mangrove swamp.
Carl never could sit still.
Right.
He was just always coming up with new ideas to the misery of his wife, because he was just always out there doing something. I mean, she had both admired that, but after a few years, it became a bit of a problem between them. But they were on their honeymoon in 1909, and they were sailing down the Mississippi and all this, and they through a fluke really got to this area near Miami. Carl's associate had taken the boat around and discovered this pretty little area with this bay, Biscayne Bay. And he wired Carl and Jane on their honeymoon, said, "You really should come see this place." So he did. Just like that. And he said, "I'm going to build a city here." Just
wow.
Just like that.
What a dreamer.
There was a guy there, a Quaker, who was trying to build a bridge across the bay. Carl thought, okay, here's a guy like unto myself, crazy, crazy right. with the big ideas.
Uh-huh.
So he lent him the money to finish the project. Then he got to work. He got the idea. Okay, we're going to make the dirt fly here. We're going to dredge out this bay and use that dirt out of the bay to fill in the swamp. Now, of course, you know, with our environmental consciousness these days, we'd probably right. deplore what he did.
Right.
But he immediately began to plan this town in his mind, set it up, began, of course, to spend more and more time down in Miami Beach. They began to live down there part of the time, almost right away, in a much more modest house. Then he later built a fine house down there, and, of course, he and well, Jane particularly was the queen of society down there. At first, there were very few takers. But then he began to offer free land to many of his associates, James Allison, Bill.
Well, because as I understand it, initially people thought he is deranged
absolutely
for doing this. Because, of course, it was a swamp.
Yeah, there was no Florida land.
And there was,
he really started what became the Florida land boom
long before air conditioning. And, in fact, I have a quote here, a quip from Will Rogers, the humorist. He said, quote, "Had there been no Carl Fisher, Florida would be known today as just the turpentine state."
That was its motto.
He rehearsed the mosquitoes until they wouldn't bite you until after you bought the land. So really, in a lot of ways, isn't Carl Fisher is probably remembered better down in Miami Beach?
In many
Beach
ways.
Than
all his accomplishments, not just as far as the speedway, but just in transportation development, things like that, all this tends to be forgotten. And Miami is usually, apart from the speedway, Miami is usually the biggest thing that is cited as an accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he lost everything.
Yes, and we'll get to that in just a minute. We have a caller on the line right now. Don is on the line. I think Don has a guess for our trivia question. Don, do you think you know the name of the famous Hoosier who persuaded Tony Holman to buy the Speedway in 1945?
Yes, it was Wilbur Shaw.
You're exactly right. How do you know that, Don?
I just know.
You're a racing fan, yeah. Enthusiast. Yeah, actually, you know, it's kind of an easy question if people have been paying attention to all the publicity this week. Well, congratulations. Stay on the line, Don, and our production staff will get your contact info, and we'll send out, you've again won two sets of tickets, one set to the Idlejorg Museum, a pair of tickets, and also a pair of tickets to Comedy Sports on Mass Ave.
Terrific. Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Yes, thanks for calling in. Well, to elaborate just a little further, as he said, it was race driver Wilbur Shaw, a three-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, who persuaded Tony Holman to buy the Speedway. Wilbur Shaw was born in Shelbyville in 1902. He started out as a teenage errand boy in Gasoline Alley. As a driver, he won the race in 1937, 1939, and 1940, making him the very first driver to earn back-to-back wins. And Wilbur Shaw, in fact, almost captured a fourth 500 victory in 1941. That was the final race before World War II. He was in the lead when a wheel hub broke off on his Maserati, causing an accident. Then after Tony Holman purchased the Speedway, he named Wilbur Shaw the president and general manager, and Wilbur Shaw became America's premier racing promoter, kind of like the Carl Fisher of a later era. And he was killed in 1954 in a private plane crash in North northeastern Indiana. Well, speaking of northern Indiana, I definitely want to bring up something related to that, and that's the Lincoln Highway.
Yes.
Carl Fisher was really quite – that was the first coast-to-coast highway,
coast-to-coast
built for cars, right?
Well, understand that they mostly used routes that already existed but connected them all and then tried to improve them.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to buy sponsorship. Local businesses mm-hmm. would buy sponsorship and pay for the paving, and then that would increase the use of the roads, get automobiles from town to town. And the whole idea was supposed to build. Many others followed, but that was the first.
It cuts across Indiana, right near where you're from. That
right
kind of sparked
from,
your
yeah.
interest in Carl
Fisher?
Yeah,
it did. I grew up, both towns I was close to growing up, with LaPorte and South Bend, their main east-west routes were called Lincoln Way because
uh-huh.
it was the Lincoln Highway. It went through New Carlisle, which is where I went to high school. They didn't change their
yeah,
name. It's also Michigan Road up there,
yeah.
too. So this is like Transportation Central up there. So I couldn't,
uh-huh.
I couldn't help but be interested in old roads. But I was always aware that there was something called the Lincoln Highway.
And that was dedicated in 1913,
yeah.
I see. And then he also started the Hoosier Motor Club.
Yes.
And I was asking,
one
Gloria, before
yeah.
that, I associate that with the AAA now and stranded motorists. But what were they doing back then?
They were finding routes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Hoosier Motor Club was part of the sponsorship of this idea mm-hmm. of the Lincoln Highway. They would go out, can you imagine these scouting parties, and try to find the best route. And that could be a route that wasn't all mud or something like that.
Right.
Which was difficult.
Exactly, back then.
So,
yeah.
And they would plot it out by landmark, not maps usually.
Wow. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Rod is on the line. Rod, do you have a question or comment for us?
I'm really enjoying your show today about Carl Fisher because it's not only topical, but I think I've always viewed Carl Fisher as sort of such a visionary. You used that word, but such a visionary that he's. I look upon him as Indiana's answer to Walt Disney because he had so many irons in the fire and was successful in so many. A couple of comments that I wanted to make. It seems almost unfair sometimes that Tony Holman is giving so much credit for exploiting the Speedway when Mr. Fisher was the originator and the founder of the Speedway and developed it through thick and thin, yet there's not much named for him, unlike Mr. Holman.
That's correct.
The other thing I wanted to mention is I'm approaching
in
the Indiana Street Fairgrounds right now where I train trotting horses, and in reading a great biography of Mr. Fisher, which is available through the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library, I learned that I believe he set some sort of a speed record here at the fairgrounds.
Yes.
Really?
In his youth.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could comment on those
what,
two things.
What is, yeah. What,
in a car.
In a car?
In 1904.
Really? Wow.
The record was 2 minutes, 2 seconds. That's it. 2 minutes, 2 seconds for 2 miles.
Wow.
Right, which was a record.
Hey.
And that was, that's of course about 60 miles an hour, which
uh-huh.
is pretty fast.
Yeah,
for
those early cars. Hey, thanks for calling in, Rod. Gloria, I want to, time flies so quickly, and I want to do a couple things here. One, to wrap up what happened to him. He financially got hard hit because
hurricane.
Yeah, a hurricane hit Miami Beach.
In 1926.
And, yes, and he, even though they rebuilt Miami Beach, he had meanwhile moved on to creating a resort on Long Island, right?
He was using the income from Miami Beach, which by 1926 was quite successful. He was using mm-hmm. that money to develop a similar resort, not tropical, obviously, mm-hmm. but again for millionaires or
right.
the equivalent,
mm-hmm.
at the east end of Long Island,
mm-hmm.
Montauk Point. And after the hurricane wiped out Miami Beach, no more income. He stopped development of Montauk Point. Miami Beach had to be rebuilt. There was just, the whole empire just folded.
Yes, and then the stock market crash hit
right.
him hard in 1929. So really the last 10 years he was,
not
if
good.
Not destitute, he certainly, close.
Not very good, unfortunately.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry we're running out of time. It's terrific to have you here, as always, Glory. And as I mentioned, I want to have you back for a show about sculptures and
That'd
monuments. And also, quickly, you've got a new book coming out.
I do. It's on Indiana State Parks called People Parks and Perceptions, A History and Appreciation of Indiana State Parks, should be out there next month, I hope.
All right. Well, yeah, well, then we'll have you on about parks, too. I'm also really looking forward to next week. Joining me in studio will be a well-known name to the Indianapolis community. My guest will be IRT playwright-in-residence James Still, who has been tackling to great acclaim Hoosier topics and historical topics. Both figure in James' brand-new original play that just opened this week at the IRT, Interpreting William. It focuses on a contemporary historian confronted by various challenges when he explores the life, the controversial life, of Hoosier pioneer William Connor and visits Connor Prairie. So I'll be talking to James about all kinds of issues related to how history gets interpreted and who gets to do it. You won't want to miss next week's show, so join us then. Again, many thanks to longtime friend, colleague, and crusader for historic preservation, Glory June Greif. Yeah, wonderful to have you here. And thanks to all of you for sharing part of your day with us today. Let's make some Hoosier history.
There's more about Hoosier History Live at our website, HoosierHistoryLive.info.